Walking through your village, lucent moonlight guides your way. Damp earth beneath your feet, and faint wood smoke fills the air. On this night, trees fall silent, lungs tighten, each step taken with bated breath. Doors are bolted, no one dares to linger outside after sunset. A neighbor, a husband, a child. Mysterious murders and disappearances frighten the community. Yet they whisper, the dead do not rest. Cattle, swine, and lamb weaken. Another has fallen ill. And a widow says, in her lonely bed beside her sat a familiar weight. Dread and despair dissipate upon the plague-stricken town. And they are left with seemingly no other choice. Open the grave. What lies beneath looks wrong. Decay is slow. Skin full, and blood-stained lips. Proof the dead are feeding. This is where the vampire is born, not in castles, not in romance, but in panic. Fear of the affliction, the dead rising, feeding, and damning others. I'm your host, Melissa Nunes, and welcome to Candle the Cryptic, your source for all things strange, spooky, and unexplained. Early vampires were more mystery than fantasy. The terror was real, not beautiful, not seductive. There were no velvet capes or immortal poets. It was a fate far more disturbing, the dead ravenous. Those who look like me, like you, like someone you knew. Early vampire legends took shape in Eastern and Central Europe between the 17th and 18th centuries, in regions that are now known as Serbia, Romania, Bulgaria, and Greece. Folklore, not as fiction, but as fact. Military officers, doctors, and priests writing and recording the same claims, graves empty, and the dead walking. Sickness swept through villages, creating a familiar pattern, a death, another falling ill, and then another, and then another. Parted visit, lingering by bedsides, children and animals weakening and wasting away. Who's to blame? The dead returning. If spotted, what was familiar was a shadow, alive and void of vitality. The answer was clear and drastic. Open the graves. Clotted soil clings to snarled tresses, while beetles and worms scurry across pale, icy skin. Like the testimonies before, they witness decay interrupted. Modern science offers evidence to the contrary. Decomposition took hold. Gases swell. Fluids seep from the mouth. Muscles relax. Eyelids fall partially, drying the surface. But these aren't modern times, and that cold stare meant they had proof. Validation for those who encountered these abominations. Now the ritual begins. By staking the heart, removing the head, and burning the remains, they stop the cycle and save the last of their community. Entire villages participated, desperate but determined. The vampire wasn't a story. It was an outbreak. Before germ theory, the only thing that seemed contagious was death itself. Suddenly, the idea of a murderous corpse seemed strangely logical. However, tuberculosis was to blame. In its grip, victims grew pale and thin, coughing up blood, then in sequence, a family member, a friend, a neighbor, would all fall ill. Communities could only watch in horror, the dead draining the living. Vampires helped them understand the unexplainable, giving shape to fear. And long before bloodthirsty heartthrobs, vampires appeared much like this, something closer to a curse than a character. This walking violation took shape in Talibah the Destroyer, written by Robert Southey, a world shaped by sorcerers, fate, and the friction between the natural and unnatural, following the hero on a quest against the dark arts. And the ghoul? A consequence of corrupt immortality, defined by contradiction, a grave-dwelling, lifeless wretch. Animated and active, a creature who lacks mystique, it exists to rise and to feed. Feared, not because of the unknown, but because it is known all too well. A man laid to rest is suspected of rising again. Bound to a tomb, he is tied to his grave. There are no theatrics, no warning. The threat is quiet, creeping, and undeniable. Illness and death follow in his wake, and suspicion turns toward what lies beneath the earth. And when it appears, it is already too late. It must be found, dug up, and destroyed. And similar to the villagers, there must be no hesitation. Decay made animate, a reminder that death, when disturbed, becomes something abhorrent. Time drew on, the vampire evolved. No longer a walking corpse, they were refined, cunning, and dangerous. In the earliest 19th century, the turning point came with the vampire, penned during a famous ghost story competition at Lake Geneva by physician Jonathan Polidori. It introduces a new kind of monster, Lord Ruthven, dignified, charming, deadly. No longer lurking in graveyards, this vampire belonged to high society, seducing, manipulating, and hunting. Within candlelit ballrooms, gilded cottages, and smoky clubs, a charm, allure, and delicious mystery that changed everything. Ruthven was the ideal aristocrat, debonair, fair-skinned, and cold, keen eyes that drew some in and unsettled others. When the man turned monster, he wasn't frenzied but deliberate, with an unnaturally still expression and a fixed, vulturous stare. Still bloodthirsty, still murderous, still undead, but now add desire. Warm breath against bare skin, teeth sunken into flesh, blood taken and given, a fervid, wanting hunger, but hunger nonetheless. It was more than murder, it was a metamorphosis, it was possession, it was power. Heart-stopping terror replaced with lust. This transformation takes shape in Quiet Intimacy in 1872 in Carmilla by Sheridan Le Fanu. There is no fury, rather warmth, persuasion, and an all-consuming craving for closeness. The monster lingers, is affectionate, and almost tender. There is nothing simple about this assault. It is confusing, layered, pain mingled with something softer, something dangerously close to pleasure. Carmilla expresses a devotion, blurring hunger and affection. As Carmilla says, "You are mine, you shall be mine, and you and I are one forever." The vampire doesn't merely take life. She shares it, claims it, and twines it with her own. Here, the bite is not an end. As Laura recalls, "I felt as if two needles ran into my breast. Very deep at the same moment, I cried aloud and awoke with a scream." Like most ancient tales, the vampire legend matured, given a voice, and eternal lives marred by loneliness and regret. As Louis said, "I wanted to be human. Even knowing what humans are, I wanted to share their feelings and their warmth, but I was a vampire, and that was my damnation." In the late 20th century, Anne Rice portrayed immortality not as freedom, but suffering. In novels like Interview with a Vampire, she dared readers to imagine the gravity of living forever. As Louis observed, the world changes, we do not. That is the irony that kills us. Everything we knew fades away, and we remain. Loved ones aging and dying. Civilizations rising and falling. Eternal hunger, insatiable and intolerable. To this, Louis says, "The hunger was always there. It never left me. Returned again and again. Each one a beautiful tragedy, immortality, and endless isolation." And inching further through time, contemporary stories like Deborah Harkness's A Discovery of Witches pushed even more boundaries, humanizing the demon, woven into shadows, hidden societies, political systems, and supernatural hierarchies as scholars, warriors, and lovers, embodying centuries of knowledge and power. As revealed by Diana Bishop, we creatures have all but disappeared, hiding in plain sight, fearful of discovery. But even the most modern allegory centers the inevitable, unending hunger. Such as when Matthew Claremont warned Diana, "You persist in this romantic vision, but I have a taste for blood." Because even in grandeur, the drive is still ancient, primal, and tied to blood. A wish, a need, a hunger too strong to be denied. Now, time circles back. The vampire sheds its refinement. In the 2024 adaptation of Nosferatu, the creature is not softened by romance or introspection. We return to something older, something closer to the grave than the drawing room. Inspired by the original 1922 film, Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror, this version resurrects the idea of the vampire not as a seducer, but as a presence, a contamination, a creeping inevitability. Count Orlok is not charming. He is a shadow, a sickness, a walking hunger. As Orlok says, I am an appetite, nothing more. He is an omen, sunken and skeletal, a decaying mass of sores and lesions. He enters not with grace, but with intrusion. He does not belong to the living world, but needs no invitation. As Ellen said, or rather Orlok through her, I shall persist to join you in every night, first in sleep, then in your arms. Everything will be mixed with abomination. You'll be knee-deep in blood. Everyone will cry. There will be none to bury the dead. Presence alters the very atmosphere, and with this we return to the plague days, but reimagined. He is a spreading rot, passing in silence from one body to the next. Over a century later, what has changed? Count Orlok was distant, ineffable, drawing others closer, not in allure, but to confront. The horror is more than the monster, but what it does. Touch without comfort. Closeness without consent. Hunger without restraint. As Ellen admits to Orlok, already overtaken, I have felt you crawling like a serpent in my body. The modern lens does not soften the monster. It sharpens it. Even as the vampire returns to his roots, carries everything that came after, the awareness of desire, the language of intimacy, the knowledge of what it means to be seen. And in that awareness, the horror deepens. Not because the vampire has changed, but because now we understand it. So why has the legend survived? The answer is simple. Vampires represent deep obsessions amongst humanity, death, and how to beat it. Humans are all too aware of their ultimate demise, but the vampire offers an alternative. Life without aging, without disease, without an ending. An endless starlit night. The price? Humanity, by becoming a predator, a parasite. The tension between terror and desire keeps people wanting more. Part of us may recoil from the vampire, while another is deeply curious. What would it be like? Somewhere by a crackling fire, friends go around sharing dark tales, and one will tell of vampires. Not because the dead rise, but because a legend awakens something primal. The fear of death, and the dangerous idea of living forever. And if vampires lurk in darkness, ravenous, waiting, and watching, they may live long enough to see their story change. Us, on the other hand, may live just long enough to lure the immortal out of the shadows. When faced with evil, they may ask, what would you give to live forever? Thanks for tuning in another episode of Kindly Cryptic. If you enjoy all things strange, spooky, and unexplained, please follow for more.